economic justice.
In this life, one thing counts. In the bank, large amounts. I'm afraid these don't grow on trees.
This is KPFA or KPFB Berkeley or KFCF Fresno. Up next, it's Cover to Cover with Jack Foley. Please stay with us.
This is Jack Foley. Today's show will be a presentation of excerpts from a speech my son Sean gave at Georgia State University. Sean is an assistant professor at DePauw University and teaches courses dealing with the Middle East. When I was a young man growing up in Northern California, Sean writes, the peoples and states of the Middle East and Muslims in general appeared to be far away and foreign. Although I had been exposed to the traditions of East Asia, Europe, and Latin America, I knew next to nothing about the religion of nearly a billion people, a religion which had been an important factor in world history, Islam. However, my outlook changed in high school when I read Guests of the Sheikh, a memoir of a young American woman's experiences when she lived in Iraq in the early 1950s. I was captivated by the book's discussion of daily life in the Middle East, the role of women in a Muslim society, Islam, and most importantly, by the fact that one of the protagonist's friends and companions in Iraq was from my hometown, Oakland, California. Suddenly, a region of the world and a religion that had seemed distant and unrecognizable was accessible and connected to my daily life. Throughout my career as an historian of the modern Middle East and the Islamic world, I have explored the regional and global historical interactions which function as the nexus of Muslim, Middle East, and world history. I have been fascinated by the devotional practices and institutions which allow Muslims who have been scattered across many national, regional, and civilizational boundaries for centuries to maintain the assertion that they are a unified community which has upheld the same principles since its inception in the Middle East in the 7th century. In particular, I have explored Muslim social and religious movements of reform and revival, including jihads. These movements interpret and employ the Quran and other seminal Islamic texts to address the evolving needs of Muslims while remaining true to Islamic values and the faith's tradition of unity. I have also explored in detail Sufi brotherhoods and other socio-economic entities which link the plethora of peoples who comprise the global Muslim community in a series of extensive and often overlapping networks. For centuries, these factors shaped how Muslims defined their identities, gender roles, and political economic structures. They have also allowed Muslims as disparate as the 14th century Moroccan traveler Ibn Battuta, the 19th century religious leader Sheikh Khalid, and the terrorist Osama bin Laden to travel throughout many states while maintaining the belief that they were still in a unified Muslim socio-cultural zone. Islamic movements, global Islamic networks, gender, political, and economic trends have not only shaped my scholarship, they have also guided my various teaching interests. Last spring, I taught an undergraduate seminar course at Georgetown University on jihads in both Africa and the Americas. That course built on the same themes that I stress in my courses at DePauw University, sociocultural history, political and economic history, and gender studies. It also provided insight into colonial American history, Latin American Caribbean history, African history, political Islam, and a number of historical narratives which are rarely seen as related. Among the most important of these narratives is the contemporary war for the soul of Islam. This debate is usually framed in terms of progressive Muslims who want to modernize their society and battle Osama bin Laden versus jihadis, who wish to impose what progressives would call a tyrannical and medieval form of Islam on the Muslim community. A significant figure in Islam's modern history is Sheikh Khalid, an early 19th century Middle Eastern Muslim religious scholar. His socio-religious order, the Naqshbandiya Khalidiyya, has numerous adherents and great influence in a variety of Muslim societies. Though far from being an Osama bin Laden, Khalid, like bin Laden, asserts that the various crises afflicting modern Muslims reflect their misguided devotion to the temporal world over the hereafter. Bin Laden and Khalid even use the same Arabic word to refer to the temporal world. Dunya. Materiality. In my PhD study of Sheikh Khalid, I analyzed the sources historians principally use to understand Khalid, letters and hagiographies, through the lens of social movement theory, an analytical framework applied extensively to contemporary European and American social movements, but which has rarely been applied to either Muslim or 19th century social movements. Social movement theory's technique of framing involves investigating three separate yet related aspects of a historical figure's career and legacy. First, how did Khalid construct his view of the world, propose solutions to sociological and political challenges, and instill faith in his followers as to the correctness and power of his solution? Second, how did he and his order win the allegiance of a wide variety of Muslims of all classes in the 1810s and 1820s, and then subsequently Muslims from vastly different linguistic, cultural, and geographic zones? Third, what values and goals are embedded in his writings, his poetry, and his correspondence? This approach is especially well-suited to discussing the Naqshbandiya, Khalidiyya, which, like many 20th century social movements, unified disparate communities behind an agenda of social and political reform. I bear in mind the fact that Sheikh Khalid lived in a time and place far removed from contemporary Muslim and Middle East societies. Issues significant then may not be significant now, and vice versa. By using this approach, I am able to draw up a portrait of Khalid's career, ideas, and long-term importance that contrasts strikingly with previous studies. These previous studies portray Khalid as a bigoted religious leader whose actions paved the way for the emergence of 20th century Sunni Muslim fundamentalism. They also argue that his success rested on an ideological program calling for the strict implementation of Islamic laws, resistance to European imperial penetration of Muslim societies, and the annihilation of Christians, Jews, and Shiites. I argue that Khalid's success reflected his ability to manipulate various aspects of his identity and teachings to convince tens of thousands of Muslims that the Naqshbandiya Khalidiyya would bring Muslim practices closer to the religion's ideals. Three reiterated themes were central to this process. Khalid's emphatic emphasis on the hereafter, his assurance that he could bring salvation to his followers on Judgment Day, and his denial of the reality of the present moment. Khalid's writings rarely touch directly on the politics of his day. They retain a timeless quality and are made to seem applicable to any period of Muslim life. Central to his effort was the implicit presentation of himself as a Muslim saint. While his followers frequently abandoned many of Sheikh Khalid's specific teachings after his death in 1827, they retained the image of Khalid as a saint in order to legitimize their own activities. Today, visitors of various nationalities and classes pay their respects to Sheikh Khalid's well-maintained tomb in Damascus, hoping to benefit from his power. Senior political and religious figures in Syria, Iraq, Turkey, Indonesia, and other parts of the Islamic world use familial or ethnic connections with him to legitimize their own power and authority. Two centuries after his death, his status as a religious figure is unquestioned. His teachings have achieved what in fact was their principal goal, solidifying Sheikh Khalid's status as a saint. If Khalid had not achieved this goal, it is unlikely that the Naqshbandiya Khalidiyya would have spread as rapidly or have become a vehicle for Muslims in all regions to resist perceived injustices and corruption, to reform and reinvigorate their societies, or battle for the soul of Islam. Since the 1830s, Naqshbandiya Khalidiya adherents have led rebellions against European imperialism and the attempts of governments to impose tighter control over Muslim populations. At the center of these movements is the image of the Prophet Saint. Allowing for differences, Sheikh Khalid is a kind of Muslim Che Guevara. His ideas are little known, but his image is everywhere. Ultimately, his movement shows that one can unify a large network of individuals around the presence or the memory of one charismatic individual, even if, as in Christianity, there is little agreement on a unifying ideology or set of ideas. The second significant contribution my dissertation makes to Middle Eastern studies has to do with demonstrating the benefits of utilizing court records and government correspondence to understand historical figures such as Sheikh Khalid. These types of records have long been a rich source for socio-economic historians of the Ottoman Empire and Syria in particular, but they also present many formidable challenges, including the fact that they were often recorded in a handwritten script, which is extremely difficult to read, even for educated native speakers. The most remarkable of the records dealing with Khalid covers one of Sheikh Khalid's four wives, Khadija, whom he selected to administer his financial affairs shortly before his death. Though she is absent from the hagiographies and other literature on Khalid's life and completely unknown today, Egyptian and Ottoman correspondence and Damascene court records tell us that Khadija oversaw Khalid's properties and pious endowment in Syria for many years and forged close ties to the Egyptian government and with senior Ottoman elites, including members of the Ottoman royal family. She negotiated directly with Ottoman officials to ensure that Khalid's descendants and relatives would not be drafted into the Ottoman army or pay taxes, and that his tomb in Damascus be well maintained with official funds. Until her death at the age of 110 in 1891, she wielded great political influence in Damascus and Istanbul. Khadija's status suggests that women may have played a far larger role in Middle Eastern public life in the 19th century than has been suggested before. Indeed, there is nothing intrinsic in Naqshbandiya Khalidiya devotional practices or Sheikh Khalid's teachings which precludes women from participating in the order or participating in political life in general. The role of women in the political life of the Middle East and the lines between temporal and spiritual power are equally critical to my first post-dissertation project, a monograph-length study entitled The Arab Gulf States, When Oil is Not Enough. The book discusses the history, socio-economics, and politics of the six Arab Gulf states, Saudi Arabia, Bahrain, Kuwait, Oman, Qatar, and the United Arab Emirates, from the 30s until the present. These six states were the birthplace of important modern Muslim reform and revival movements. Their large expatriate South Asian, Southeast Asian, and African populations demonstrate the ongoing importance of socio-economic networks which have united the global Muslim community for centuries. This is especially true for those communities along the Indian Ocean. These same networks assisted the diffusion of the Naqshbandiya Khalidiya in the 19th century from Iraq, Turkey, and Syria to North Africa, Central Asia, Indonesia, and China. In my book, I present a fresh approach to understanding the Arab Gulf states, an approach which provides a viable alternative to the analytical model most often used to understand these states, the Rentier model. The Rentier model contends that the revenue from petroleum exports dictates political and economic power in these states, since it gives the governing elites enormous wealth without their having to negotiate or interact with the rest of society to acquire the resources necessary to govern. Yet, over the past 6 years, the opposite has occurred to what the Rentier model predicts. Though energy prices have increased and the state's revenues from oil sales have soared, elections have occurred in five of these six states, and groups outside of the governing elites, women, Shiites, expatriates, and religious and secular opposition groups have taken far more visible public roles than ever before. To explain the new conditions, I argue that we must reframe Saudi Arabia, Bahrain, Kuwait, Oman, Qatar, and the UAE, collectively known as the GCC, as normal states, which face many of the same problems as other states. We also must seek to transcend the confines of past approaches and highlight the role of actors as varied as foreign investors, women, Shiites, and expatriate communities. In addition, we must raise a question which has never appeared in the scholastic literature about these states. Is it possible to think of these states without beginning and ending our discussion with petroleum? Here it is worth noting that many of the central socio-political issues that the six states face, the rivalries and mutual suspicions between large and small states in the Persian Gulf region, tensions between Iraq and Kuwait and Sunni Shiites, predate the oil boom and will continue into the indefinite future. Asking such a question shatters the premise of the rentier model, that the proceeds from the sale of petroleum are the central element of any analysis of Saudi Arabia, Bahrain, Kuwait, Oman, Qatar, and the UAE. Broadening our analysis beyond petroleum reveals the breadth of socio-economic and political factors and actors that shape the destiny of GCC societies. For instance, the principal beneficiaries of recent political and economic reforms in GCC societies have been women. Little scholarship exists on the history of women in GCC societies. In stark contrast to other regions of the Middle East and the Islamic world, women have gained an increasingly prominent position in the private and public sectors. The research that has been done focuses on the discussions among GCC men regarding the legitimacy of extending the franchise to women GCC nationals, and is usually drowned out in larger debates over modernity and Islam in the 1990s and beyond. These discussions miss a larger point. Women in GCC societies acquired ever greater socio-economic power in the 1990s because they were the only group besides expatriates who were able to fill the positions created by the private sector. Women benefited from the enormous investment of GCC governments in education after the 1970s, especially in secondary and post-secondary education. Since younger GCC women, on average, are more literate and stay in school longer than their male counterparts, this gap will only widen in the future, especially in computer and other advanced technical industries where women dominate the workforce. Though an ever greater percentage of women is now participating in the workforce, the majority of educated GCC women become housewives after their schooling. How to reconcile the desire to utilize educated women more effectively within the conservative framework of GCC society remains an important and troubling question for GCC governments and their peoples. Extending the right to vote to women and permitting them to drive, issues which make headlines today, will look minor in comparison to those issues facing GCC states when women emerge as the only segment of the indigenous population qualified to work in the state's modern economies. Indigenous men show few signs of wishing to compete with them. They prefer working in the army or government, occupations that do not require extensive education. I emphasize that the GCC states are normal states, which face many of the same challenges that other states have faced for many decades. While there is no doubt that petroleum will play a critical role in the GCC economies for many years to come, I question whether petroleum is the only factor to be considered. I believe that this is a question which will vex scholars for many years as GCC societies transform into diversified economies in which oil plays a significant but ever less vital role over time. Increasingly, petroleum rents will be simply an exogenous income that reduces their rate of taxation in the same way that it does for the people of Mexico, whose government receives 20% of its revenues annually from oil sales. Communicating to students the importance of the various networks, historical linkages, and narratives which lie at the heart of my work on Sheikh Khaled and the Arab Gulf states is central to my approach to teaching freshman world history courses and specialized courses. A critical component to that approach is to remember what it means to be a learner, a student. One must not only instruct one's students, one must be a student oneself. The classroom environment is one in which teachers and students listen actively, approach the ideas of others seriously, and seek out opportunities in which knowledge is exchanged rather than imposed by one person on another. I have striven to actualize these perceptions in my own experiences as a lecturer because I believe they offer the best approach for training students to independently understand and evaluate the history and contemporary socio-political conditions of Muslim societies. Fundamentally, one is trying to awaken one's students to something new. I have been very fortunate to have been able to study and work with a host of skilled instructors, especially Georgetown University's Dr. John Vole. One insight that I gained from Dr. Vole is the importance of the 14th century Muslim traveler Ibn Battuta to Islamic and world history. Throughout his long career, Battuta visited dozens of Muslim communities and states from West Africa to South Asia, and he cared little who was governing as long as they upheld his vision of a properly managed Muslim society. As long as the ruler ensured the continuation of Islamic law and cultural norms, it mattered little to Battuta whether he was physically in the Maldives, Egypt, or India. Battuta's ability to travel throughout so many states while maintaining the belief that he was in a unified socio-cultural zone points to the possibility that a global community could exist which is not politically or economically united. Equally importantly, it alludes to the existence of a unified global community long before the invention of the Internet, satellites, and the other technologies that we commonly associate today with globalization. Discussions provide important opportunities for students to develop their critical thinking skills and to be prepared to contribute to their communities. Thinking about historical events in greater depth opens students to new and alternative narratives, along with linkages between past events and those of the present, some of which are not obvious or appear counterintuitive. A good way to reinforce the impact of this process is to introduce students to the questions that professional historians ask about materials. Who wrote the document? What is the context for the document? What are its sources? And are its conclusions credible? By exposing students to this method of analysis, we can help them see that history is never over. The process of both remembering and assigning significance to past events occurs in the present and is always open to question. While this approach is directly applicable to traditional historical texts, it could easily be applied to online magazine articles, a political speech, or the nightly television news. In addition, this approach will help to prepare college students to manage the challenges of living in an age in which events thousands of miles from home can impact their lives and in which there is a plethora of sources of news and information that have widely different editorial policies and journalistic standards. All my courses would frame either a specific issue or community within the context of the global Muslim community and world history generally. In particular, I emphasize that the themes of these classes are not grounded in a region or group of regions. Rather, they are part of overlapping networks and political and religious communities which are global in scope and effect. One cannot envision any of my courses outside of the intellectual framework of world history. There is little question that the events of the last 5 years have made the already formidable task of teaching modern Middle Eastern and world history more difficult than ever before. Middle Eastern and Islamic peoples have been transformed in our national consciousness from the faraway masters of world oil prices to potential fanatics capable of killing thousands instantly and on American soil. These perceptions have been reinforced by an intense debate within Islamic and Middle Eastern studies, often revolving around differing perspectives of the Arab-Israeli conflict and an alleged clash of civilizations. As an instructor, conscious of the position of my students as learners, I try to expose students to differing perspectives on the significant issues in modern Middle Eastern, Islamic, and world history, and trust that they will be able to form opinions on their own. The French poet Jean Cocteau was once asked what he would save if his house were to catch fire. Cocteau's answer was, "I would save the fire. The various components of the house of history are of immense importance and need to be discussed. But most of all, a teacher and a scholar must be able to communicate the fire." This is Jack Foley. You've been listening to excerpts from a speech written by my son, Sean Foley. Sean delivered the speech at Georgia State University on November 30th, 2005. The title of the speech is World History as a Framework for Middle East and Islamic History. Before closing, I'd like to mention some upcoming events. Adele and I will be reading at Copperfields in Santa Rosa with our friend Richard Silberg on this Friday at 7. Copperfields is located at 2316 Montgomery Drive in Santa Rosa. That's this Friday at 7. On Sunday, March 5th, I'll be reading without Adele as part of the Crossroads, the Irish-American Festival. Co-readers will be Catherine Hastings, Maureen Hurley, and Chad Sweeney. We'll all be reading at Bird and Beckett Books, 2788 Diamond Street at Chinnery in San Francisco. That reading, Bird and Beckett Books, 2788 Diamond Street at Chinnery, will be at 7:30. Also, the wonderful singer Maud Maggart will be appearing from March 7th through March 12th at the Plush Room at the York Hotel in San Francisco. Phone toll-free 866-468-3399 for tickets and information. She'll be doing an all Irving Berlin program. Anyone who's heard her new CD knows that she was born to sing, and particularly born to sing Irving Berlin. That's Maud Maggart, phone 866-468-3399. If you have any comments about this show or any of my others, you can send them to me at Box 84, KPFA, Berkeley, 94704, or phone 510-848-6767, extension 630. Listen to Richard Walensky on tomorrow's Cover to Cover. I'll be back in 2 weeks. I don't pass the physical for International Women's Day. Thank you, Ms. M., and thanks for listening.
Visión presents the opening night of Electricidad Saturday, March 11th at the Mexican Heritage Plaza Theater in San Jose. This will be a benefit for Teatro Visión's community and student performances. A Chicano take on the Greek classic Electra, Electricidad is an intense and poetic look at how lust for power can destroy a community. Electricidad will run March 9th to April 2nd, Thursdays through Sundays, with evening and matinee performances. More information about Electricidad is available at www.teatrovision.org.
This is KPFA or KF... or KFCF Fresno. Coming up next, it's Free Speech Radio News. Please.